Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wherever you are on your well-being journey, Audible is there for you. You'll discover voices that motivate to spark you to take action.
The best time to start is right now.
There are sounds to soothe, so you can focus, reduce stress, and sleep better. Stories to inspire, so you can dream big again.
One liftoff.
And a range of personalities, so you'll have a partner on your journey. Get closer to the best you with bestsellers, new releases, and exclusive originals, all ad-free. Listen now on Audible.
Unmissable stories from around the globe. From the BBC World Service.
My happy place, this is who I am.
Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday, February the 14th, these are our main stories. Early unofficial results from Indonesia's presidential election suggest the defence minister and former general Prabowo Subianto is on course to secure victory. Ukraine's military says it's destroyed a Russian warship in the Black Sea. And for a second day, Indian police have used tear gas and water cannon to stop protesting farmers from marching on the capital, Delhi. Also in this podcast, Notre Dame's spire rises from the ashes. Nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. We hear what it's like to be trapped in Rafah amid the looming threat of an Israeli ground attack. And
there's a long competition. I have neck ache at this moment, so I think I need some rest.
Ivory Coast's victorious manager looked forward to a well-earned rest after winning the Africa Cup of Nations. We start in Indonesia, where early polling samples after today's election give a clear lead to the Defence Minister Prabowo Subianto, who's hoping to win the presidency on the first round. Full results aren't due until next month, but the state approves a so-called quick count beforehand. Indonesia's outgoing president, Joko Widodo, has been criticised for giving undue support to Mr. Prabowo's campaign, which featured Mr. Widodo's son as his running mate. After casting his ballot, the outgoing president spoke to reporters.
This is a celebration of democracy. We hope it will be the people's celebration as well. And I hope it will go safely, honestly, directly, free and confidential, and be followed by all Indonesian people with joy. Because this is the People's Party, a party of democracy.
Our correspondent in Jakarta is Jonathan Head. He's been following the results.
Well, they do these what they call quick counts, which are a bit like exit polls, and a lot of different polling groups do them. They are known to be pretty accurate. What they're telling us is that Prabowo Subianto, the defence minister, the most controversial candidate by far, who's been ahead for months now, has probably done a good deal better even than they predicted before the election. All of the exit polls suggest he's easily exceeded the 50% threshold that will give him an outright win over his two rivals in this first round and make him president. So I'm down at his the place where his supporters have gathered. He's supposed to arrive here sometime over the next hour, and I imagine he will claim victory and they will all celebrate. There's a very celebratory mood here anyway, and a very despondent one in the counts of his rivals. It had been expected to be a much closer race between the three of them. But Prabowo Subianto simply built up a momentum and lead in vote counting that has left the others far behind.
And there have been some allegations of election fraud as well.
Well, one of the camps, one of the candidates, Ganjar Pranowo, has alleged they have evidence of what they're calling massive electoral fraud. We've got no indication as to whether there are real grounds for that at this stage or not. The real complaints of Prabowo's rivals, particularly Ganjar's camp, remember, the real complaint relates to President Jokowi's support of Prabowo. Not just that he's lent his immense popularity to him, but also that he managed to get an extremely controversial constitutional court ruling that allowed his son to run as Prabowo's running mate, even though he's under the minimum age. And that's alarmed and outraged a lot of people. You know, President Jokowi used to be with the other camp, the camp of what's now the third ranking candidate, Ganjar. So there's a lot of dismay about the way he switched sides at the last minute, and that he's backed a candidate who is so controversial, a fiery, outspoken man with a record of very anti-democratic comments and a spotty human rights record. For a lot of Indonesians, that makes this a very worrying result indeed.
Jonathan Head. More than a million people are sheltering in Rafah after fleeing the fighting in Israel's war with Hamas. And the UN humanitarian coordinator, Martin Griffiths, has said an Israeli ground offensive in southern Gaza could lead to a slaughter. Stefan Dujarric, a spokesman for the Secretary-General, told us the UN would not participate in any forced evacuation.
Our focus is on the protection of those civilians in Gaza and ensuring that no one is forcibly displaced. And I can tell you clearly that the United Nations will not be party to any forced displacement of people. You have now over a million human beings who are crammed into Rafah under extremely challenging situation, including with fighting going on around them. Any military operation in Rafah would be catastrophic, to say the least.
Meanwhile, there are reports the Israeli military has ordered Palestinians to evacuate the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in the south of the Gaza Strip. Our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher in Jerusalem has this assessment of the latest warnings from the UN.
I would say that it reflects unprecedented concern from UN agencies, aid agencies, about the situation in Rafah, which is already very difficult for the people there and for the aid people trying to help them. But then you have the Israeli announcement that it plans to expand its war into the city to send ground forces in to finish its conflict with Hamas. So the Israelis have said they would have an evacuation plan. But basically, I think the UN is saying that's not really possible under the circumstances. What Mr. Griffiths, the top official, humanitarian official at the UN, said, military operations in Rafah could lead to a slaughter in Gaza. He said the already fragile humanitarian operation could be at death's door if that happened. And he basically said it's already not working. It's in tatters. We lack the safety guarantees, the aid supplies and the staff capacity to keep this operation afloat, that Israel should heed the warnings about such an operation. And then he ended by saying history will not be kind. So it's a very stark warning, and it reflects how concerned UN aid agencies are about the situation. The Israelis have not given details of what they say would be an evacuation plan for the more than 1 million civilians who've taken refuge there. And the UN spokesperson has said that they haven't seen a plan. But given how they're struggling to meet the situation as it is, the inadequate water, shelter, food for the people there, they're just not in a position to create a whole nother location for them. They have responded very, very strongly against this proposed military incursion.
And of course, there were talks in Cairo yesterday about a possible ceasefire, but they appear to have ended in deadlock.
There were high-level talks. They involved the intelligence chiefs of Egypt, United States and Israel, and the Prime Minister of Qatar. And these four had previously drafted a framework for a ceasefire proposal. That didn't go very far because Hamas made some amendments to it and Israel strongly rejected its conditions. So this is the first meeting since that. And there wasn't a breakthrough. The gaps are still wide. What we understand from some reports is that the main sticking point is the ratio of Israeli hostages that would be released in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. That would be involving a six-week pause or ceasefire in order to do that and also to get aid into Gaza. So they are still continuing. And I think the hope now is, amongst other things, that this might head off or postpone any kind of Israeli offensive into Rafah.
Barbara Plett-Usher. Amid all the diplomatic activity and the focus on Israel's proposed military action, it's easy to forget the daily reality of life facing thousands of civilians now trapped in Rafah. Victoria Uwankunda has been talking to one of them, Dina, who's been displaced five times since October and has fled to Rafah from her home in the north of the Gaza Strip.
I get displaced 5 times. This is my 5th. The past 2 days was very devastating and dreadful. Rafah is getting intensive, and people are thinking about displacing, and everyone's trying to find a place. A lot of people that I know and myself, we don't have another place to go. We are originally from the north. We don't have a lot of choices in the south, and Rafah was our last choice, and now it's very bad.
How does that feel like, being displaced 5th time, you say you have been? Now you are in Rafah and it's getting intense, as you are describing. How does it feel being in such a situation?
I think it's very, very bad. Like, displacing was, this is the first time I am displaced in an attack on Gaza. And this is the most difficult thing. When I get displaced the first time from the north, I left everything in my house. I didn't take anything. We just ran away fast. We get in the car and we switched on the car and we ran away and we left everything. It is very bad to feel displaced.
Yeah, I mean, I know all about feeling displaced. I went through similar things with the war back in the 90s from my own home country, Rwanda. But you say you've lost your home. Have you lost any family members?
Yes, I do. I lost my brother-in-law and my nephew.
I'm so sorry for your loss, Dina. Being there under intensive bombardment, mm-hmm. and also the shops, I imagine, they've been closed for months. And we keep hearing, yes, about medication and medicine and hospitals being shut down because there is nothing that is coming in. What is like daily life for you?
That's true. Shops and bakeries are closed. Even if you have money, you wouldn't find anything to buy. The medication shortage is very problematic too, because I am an asthma patient. I caught a respiratory virus. They couldn't find a cough syrup. And I started to cough blood. And we tried everywhere and tried to talk to everyone. They said, truly, there is no medication. You wouldn't find it because it doesn't enter since four months. I have lived in Gaza for 27 years. It's like you see a place for 27 years, but you don't know it anymore.
Dina talking to Victoria Uwankunda. It's been almost 5 years since the spire of the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris collapsed during the devastating fire. Since then, it's been hidden from view, covered in scaffolding, while restoration work was undertaken. Now parts of the spine are visible once again. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
It's not the end, but maybe it's the beginning of the end. For years, Parisians have grown accustomed to the cranes and the scaffolding creeping ever higher over the shell of Notre Dame. Now the process has reversed, and the scaffolding is slowly, painstakingly coming down, revealing today, like a receding tide, just the very pinnacle of the new spire, surmounted by a cross, and on top of that, a statuette of a golden cock, just like the one that disappeared in the blaze. For Philippe Just, president of the Notre Dame Renovation Agency, it's a powerful moment.
People are impatient to see the cathedral rebuilt, and this impatience is increasing as we get closer to the opening. The fall of the spire was the most dramatic moment of the fire, so to see the spire finally rebuilt, it's like the healing of a wound.
The spire is made from oak beams, and the last task of the craftsmen and women on the scaffolding is cladding the wood in lead, the soft metal malleable enough to show the art that's gone into the carpentry. After this, the rest of the wooden roof, the forest as it's known in French, will need to be covered, and there are new safety mechanisms to be installed, like water sprayers to cut the risk of another fire. After the conflagration, they gave themselves 5 years to get the restoration completed. It seemed ambitious, but it looks like they might come in on time.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Still to come.
What they're going to do is they're going to have an entirely performative impeachment so that they can go into the election saying immigration is in terrible shape and we impeach the administration official who is responsible for that policy.
An historic day for the US Congress. But will it make any difference? Ukrainian naval drones and military forces have attacked and sunk a Russian warship which was anchored off the occupied Crimean Peninsula. The Cesar Kunikov, a large landing ship, was near the resort town of Alupka in Ukraine's territorial waters. It's the latest in a series of successful attacks on the Russian fleet. Speaking ahead of a NATO defence minister meeting in Brussels, Jens Stoltenberg praised the Ukrainian military.
And this is a great achievement, a great victory for the Ukrainians. The fact that they've been able to push away the Russian Black Sea fleet and open a corridor, so they now are able to export grain and other commodities to the world market. Few believe this was possible just a few months ago.
Our correspondent in Kyiv, James Waterhouse, told us more.
We have a claim from Ukraine's military that the Cesar Kunikov was destroyed by marine drones packed with explosives, which, as you say, they've used to great effect. They're manufactured mostly in Ukraine, and I think the use of those, along with longer-range missiles, has enabled Ukraine to degrade Russia's navy significantly. Now, there is footage that which has also been released by the armed forces, which appears to show the landing ship being hit by an onboard camera on the marine drone. There was a column of black smoke which could be seen out on the horizon of the Black Sea. Nothing yet from the Russian installed officials there, but it suggests that it has lost another landing vessel, a second in almost as many months. And this is significant because for Russian forces in the south of Ukraine, it is by sea which is the most efficient way for it to shift soldiers and equipment. This landing ship in question could carry up to 300 troops. It could carry 12 armoured vehicles. And so the destruction of a fourth landing ship of this size severely hampers Russia's ability to manoeuvre and supply troops in the south. And this is part of Ukraine playing a longer game as it tries to cut off the occupied Crimean Peninsula, which Russia has held on to since 2014. Unfortunately for Kyiv, it is a different story on the front lines where, you know, generals are seriously considering retreating in some areas as Russian land forces continue to launch endless attacks.
And there have been reports on Reuters that Vladimir Putin was proposing a ceasefire to the US via intermediaries. That's been denied by the Kremlin. How would the Kyiv view that?
Well, I think Kyiv would make the point it always has done, which is a ceasefire isn't even worth the paper it is written on. I think Kyiv points to recent history of the last, you know, quarter of a century, where you have Russia at one point saying it would recognise Ukraine's borders with the collapse of the Soviet Union, with the agreement that it would Kyiv would surrender its nuclear arsenal, with the ceasefires in the outbreak of the war in 2014, which Russia has always gone back on. I think what Kyiv is really worried about is if it was to come under mounting pressure from the West to accept some kind of ceasefire or a concession on territory, Russia, Vladimir Putin, will launch an attack of a greater scale down the line, because it is Kyiv and the whole of Ukraine, which he has always wanted, and I can't see that changing anytime soon.
James Waterhouse. And Ukraine is the main topic on the agenda at that NATO defence minister's meeting. It's taking place a day after the US Senate passed a $95 billion aid package. Much of that will go to Ukraine. But they also have in their minds Donald Trump's comments at the weekend, in which he said he'd encourage Russia to attack NATO countries who are not investing enough in defence. At a news conference ahead of that meeting, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg confirmed a majority of NATO members would hit the 2% target in defence spending.
This year, I expect 18 allies to spend 2% of the GDP on defence. That is another record number, and a six-fold increase from 2014, when only three allies met the target. However, some allies still have a way to go, because we agreed at the Vilnius summit that all allies should invest 2%, and that 2% is a minimum.
Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale is in Brussels. I asked him how much of Jens Stoltenberg's comments were down to what Donald Trump had said.
Jens Stoltenberg was very careful not to say anything that antagonised Donald Trump, because people here know that it is a possibility that he may once again be president. I mean, it was very difficult when they were working with him when he was president, and Jens Stoltenberg trod a very careful path. He didn't mention Donald Trump today by name, but the reality is that more countries are spending more on their defence in NATO, not because of Donald Trump's cajoling, but because of what Vladimir Putin has done in Ukraine. And if you look at the figures, when they set the 2% figure, meeting 2% of GDP spent on defence in 2014, that was when Vladimir Putin essentially invaded Crimea. And now, at the end of this year, there will be 18 of the 31 members so far of NATO who will probably meet that 2% goal. So there has been a dramatic change, and that dramatic change is down to Vladimir Putin rather than Donald Trump. Though some countries still needed to be chivvied up to spend 2%, because, as I said, it's 18 of 31, not all of the 31.
And is this money enough?
Well, I mean, it depends what you mean. Is it enough for what? I mean, of course, the concern of lots of countries on Russia's borders, NATO countries, like the Baltic states, like Poland, and they are the ones that have increased defence spending massively, is that they could be next, theoretically, if President Putin got his way in Ukraine. So in terms of is it enough, I mean, you look at NATO's defence spending overall against Russia's, including all the countries, and assuming that all NATO countries would respond if a NATO member was attacked, then yes, NATO does spend more on defence than Russia, and also gets probably more advanced military equipment, which they've been giving to Ukraine, and clearly today we've seen had some success. For example, we're seeing the Ukrainians using deep strikes inside Russian-held territory inside Ukraine, like in the Black Sea, like in Crimea, and destroying Russian warships. So the belief here is that they are in a much better place here now than they were in 2014 in providing that collective defence for their allies against any Russian threat.
Jonathan Beale. For only the second time in US history, the House of Representatives has impeached a sitting member of the president's cabinet. Republicans have been targeting the Homeland Security Secretary, Alejandro Mayorkas, saying he didn't do enough to enforce the immigration laws, which resulted in a record number of migrants crossing the Mexican border. More than 6 million have entered the country illegally since 2021. And the vote was won by the narrowest margin, one vote. Professor Frank Bowman teaches at the Missouri School of Law. He testified to the impeachment panel back in January and warned them the secretary hadn't actually committed an impeachable offence. And he's been telling Luke Jones what he makes of the House's move.
In the United States, impeachment is a constitutional tool, which is among the gravest and really most solemn constitutional processes. And to impeach someone, whether it's a president or a cabinet officer, one must show treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And that bar plainly has not been met.
And the understanding is that even though this has passed in the lower house, 214 to 213, so by a whisker, it will fail in the upper chamber, the Senate. Why is that?
First reason, of course, is that the Constitution requires a two-thirds majority in the Senate for there to be a conviction, which would require 67 of 100 votes. And, of course, the Democrats hold a majority, 51-49. None of them will vote for this, and I think a fairly significant number of Republicans will not. So the chances of this passing or a conviction being achieved by a majority of 67 is next to zero.
So this is just a bit of theater, you think, then, essentially?
Well, exactly. And I think we have to understand what's going on here. You have to understand what is happening not only with this impeachment, but with substantive legislation on immigration that was actually put together by a bipartisan negotiating group not too long ago, last week or so, that actually addresses real serious immigration problems we have in the United States at the southern border. And instead, what they're going to do is they're going to have an entirely performative impeachment of Secretary Mayorkas so that they can go into the election saying, oh, immigration is in terrible shape, and we impeach the administration official who is responsible for that policy, carefully not saying that they refuse to actually do anything substantive about it themselves.
Around the time of the impeachment of Donald Trump, that there was lots of concern from commentators that this would become the new normal, that there would be a tit-for-tat impeachment, and Republicans would always try to impeach Democrats and the other way around. Are we seeing that playing out now? It's now a political tool more than it ever was.
I think with the Mayorkas impeachment, that is what we're seeing. I want to be clear, however, that I do not think that either of the Trump impeachments were political in the narrowly partisan sense. He was impeached because he committed impeachable offenses. Mm. He did serious things that were, you know, contrary to the American constitutional order.
Professor Frank Bowman talking to Luke Jones. South Korean officials have confirmed to the BBC that hackers in the north have managed to break into the personal emails of a member of the South Korean president's team. The breach occurred during the run-up to President Yoon Suk-yeol's state visit to the UK last November. Jean McKenzie reports from Seoul.
The North Korean hacker was reportedly able to access the president's schedule for his state visit in November, as well as emails sent by the president himself. The government aide had been using his personal email account to plan the trip to London, during which President Yoon met King Charles and Queen Camilla, as well as the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. The president's office here has confirmed to us that the hack took place, but it wouldn't detail what information was stolen. It said its security hadn't been breached and blamed the careless actions of one of its employees. Pyongyang is increasingly using cyber hacking to steal both large amounts of money to fund the regime, as well as sensitive state secrets.
Jean McKenzie. Protesting Indian farmers have clashed with the police after resuming their march towards the capital, Delhi. Video footage showed drones being used to drop tear gas on the marchers. And the farmers are demanding minimum guarantee prices for a range of crops, debt relief, and a withdrawal of cases brought against some of them during previous protests. Harinder Singh is a protesting farmer who has travelled nearly 500 kilometres to Delhi from Amritsar.
We will not leave until our demands are met, because our trust has been betrayed once before by the government. There are about 200 to 250 groups of farmers supporting us. Wait and watch. This protest will be on a much larger scale than the last one.
Our South Asia editor Ambarasa Natarajan told me more.
There are tens of thousands of farmers, but still we have not seen the level of participation what we witnessed in 2020 and 2021. But the intensity is quite high at this moment because farmers, as you said, they try to break through this barrier set up by police, like the cement blocks, barricades and spikes, but they were stopped by security forces at one of the borders about 200 kilometers north of Delhi. And we saw the drones, footage showed that how drones were dropping the tear gas canisters. Now, the farmers were countering that by flying kites in the hope of the blades of the drones can get entangled in the rope of this kite. So that one way of that was a big amusement how they were trying to chase the police drones. In the meantime, the government has asked the farmers to come for talks, and then they say we will look into your demands. But one of the ministers also made it very clear that it is not possible to accommodate all the demands, particularly assured floor prices, like giving them a minimum guaranteed price, because they have to consult all the stakeholders.
And how many farmers do you believe will be in this for the long haul? They will carry on for as long as it takes.
The pictures show that there are hundreds of tractors with the trailers where the farmers have come well prepared with food and tent material and also prepared for the rain. So they say that they are in for a long haul, even for about 6 months of food they have packed. And that is why they are near the border. And in fact, they are making food and distributing to other people. Now, what we have to see is whether other farmers' unions are joining. Now, already there are some groups which say that they are going to do to intensify the protest against this police action by stopping rail traffic for about 4 hours in the state of Punjab. So if the police action continues, if there is a deadlock in the talks between the two sides, and there is a possibility that other farmers' unions from other states could also join, in that case, the protest will get intensified.
Ambarasan Etarajan. Everybody loves a sporting comeback. And the Ivory Coast produced one of the best in many years to win the African Cup of Nations on home turf. Their match winner in the final against Nigeria was Sebastien Allaire, who recovered from cancer before resuming his career at the highest level. And it was the culmination of a remarkable turnaround during the tournament. The Ivorians squeezed into the knockout rounds after finishing third in their group. They were hammered 4-0 by Equatorial Guinea and looked to be in disarray. But the coach, Jean-Louis Gasset, was dramatically sacked midway through the tournament. And his replacement, Amers Fay, masterminded what then followed. He's been talking to Sarah Menai about an extraordinary story and began by describing the mood in the dressing room after the humbling by Equatorial Guinea.
A nightmare. The player were disappointed. We didn't expect to lose that by way. I think the only one that takes the taken is was the president, and he say it's not finished.
What did you have to do to change? Was it in the speech?
Was it in the way you were doing things with your players? Was it because you played for Ivory Coast? You know this team, you know this country, you're one of them. Is that the thing that maybe, you know, changed the approach for the players and also for you? Was it easier for you to talk to them and motivate them as well?
The most important, the player needs some confidence. They have qualities. Everybody know that. But at this moment, we need confidence. Our speech with the staff technique were, let's go, guys. You're a good player. Forget what happened. You are very, very good players. Think something else about it. And I say to the player, we need to be a unit. We need to be a block.
As a player, Immerse, you lost an AFCON finals in 2006 against Egypt in Cairo. Now at home, you win it as a manager for your first time on the bench. Is it personally for you a sort of a little revenge as well?
Yeah, it was so important for me. I lost one in final, one in semi-final, and one in quarter-final. After that, I had to stop my career for a health problem. When I stopped my career, I said, when I couldn't win as a player, I have to do it as manager. To do this in my country, it's beautiful. It's so beautiful. It's a revenge, not only as my international career. It's a revenge of life because I stopped my career at 28. I felt good, but I have to stop because it was too dangerous for my life. I'm very happy for my family too, because it's not too easy for my wife and my two little girls to have this moment too. And I'm very happy for them. It was a long, long competition. And I have neck ache at this moment. So I think I need some rest.
Immerse Faye, the manager of the victorious Ivory Coast team at this year's African Cup of Nations. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Emma Crow, and the producer was Mark Duff. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.